The materials that are before you are much more comprehensive. I can't do the materials justice in an hour if I'm to do a survey of all the materials. The intention is that you'll take the materials back and you'll put it on your computer and you'll look at it from time to time and reference it, and you'll have the aha moment. It's like, yeah, that's part of the material. Stuart touched on that. There's some things today I do want to touch on more in depth, but do view the materials as much more comprehensive than what we'll have an opportunity to address today. Also keep this in mind, too. This presentation is for a wide audience, both on a horizontal scale and also a vertical scale as well. By horizontal, I mean this. I'm speaking to attorneys. I'm speaking to accountants. I'm speaking to financial advisors, insurance advisors, bank officers, trust officers, and I suppose a few who are here for the credit as well, right? Got it. I want to deliver information in a very professional way that will help you in your various professional practices, that will make you a better advisor. I also want to deliver the material, though, too, in a very personal, practical way, because there may be some suspicion in your family about what's going on. There may be some ways to help a senior, to be proactive, to avoid any of those things that's going on as well. And so I want to present this material in a way that's both valuable to you, both as advisors in your professional lives, as well as practical to you in your personal lives as well. So with that, let me introduce you to Mabel Nelson. Mabel Nelson, a good Minnesota name, right? Mabel Nelson. I learn of Mabel because her daughter calls me. Now, just a word. You mentioned I work at Chestnut Cambrone. I do. A lovely law firm in the Twin Cities, mid-sized firm, 30 lawyers. 9 of us are in the estate planning group. We call ourselves the Fine Nine. You know, it's us, right? Got it. So, a lawyer in private practice. I want to sell my time. I don't want to make any bones about that. Of course I do. I roll into the office about 8 o'clock in the morning. The message light is on. That's a good thing, right? When somebody wants to talk to you as a lawyer, it's a good thing, right? So I return the call, and it's from Mabel's daughter, Judy. And Judy says, oh, you know, I need to get to you right away. My mom needs to meet with you right away. I was looking at mom's will over the past weekend. Let us pause. Is that a normal thing that people do? Hey, mom, it's Saturday morning. Let's not sleep in. Let's wake up. Let's look at the will. Okay, all right. And, you know, there's a lot of things in that will that are just wrong. It was done 20 years ago, and things are outdated. Pause. In my personal practice, the way I try to reel in my clients is I tell them there's 2 data points to keep in mind in any estate plan, regardless of age. One is, in my mind's eye, I hope my clients live a long life. I really do. I hope they have a good, productive, healthy life, and they pass away ultimately in a very peaceful way. In other words, like the prophet Moses, they live to 120, and they go up the mountain, and they slip away, and that's wonderful. With good health insurance, too, I might add. Moses had good health insurance, right? Yeah, so that's one data point. But a second, more realistic data point is, in my view, the shelf life of any good estate plan is 3 to 5 years. Now, that's not to say that we throw it away every 3 to 5 years, but we look at it. At least we're going to look at it. It's maybe not so much the law changes, although we know the substantive changes of the law today from attending this seminar and the courses I attended right before lunch about the changes in Oregon and Washington law. I get that. But really what changes the most is we as human beings. People come in and out of our life, right? Think about your own personal life 5 years ago. And then bring it back to 10 years ago. Who were the important people in your life? What did your family situation look like? Professionally, where were you at, right? So you can see changes, things that were different, right, 5, 10 years ago. You can only imagine that things are going to continue to change in the next 5 and 10 and whatever it goes on in the future. So that's the shelf life. So maybe daughter's not so wrong that things have changed, whatever they are. But then daughter tells me this. She starts dictating, like I'm a short order cook, what mom needs. You know, she needs one of those wills. Okay. You know, the kind that avoid probate. Okay. Okay. And she needs one of those power of attorney documents. Uh-huh. And she needs one of those health care directive documents. Uh-huh. Oh, and she needs one of those quick deeds. quick deeds. You mean quit claim deed? Yeah. One of those quit claim deeds. You know, she, because boy, the nursing home's going to take her home, and she wants to leave it all to me. In fact, she wants me to make me the representative, and I should get all the assets. And we want everything protected from the big bad nursing home. Okay. Well, I don't know if I want to wade into these waters, but I'm intrigued, right? I'm intrigued. And in my practice, I don't charge for the first meeting. I want to give that away. So it's not that I want to make any money. I'll spend an hour of my life that I'll never get back meeting with these people, right, and see what's going on. Because it could go, I'm painting a picture right now, it could go either way. Maybe daughter is just all hepped up and she wants to really help mom, because for most of our clients in this area, they've really never dealt with an attorney before. They really haven't. And maybe they even have some negative things. I know it's hard to say, but negative things about a lawyer, right? It's like we have the ethics this side of a used car salesman, and that we are, how do I say it, we are underworked and overpaid. Right? And we that work for the hourly wage know that that's not necessarily the case. So I want to set up a meeting, and I want to make it clear that I want mom at the meeting. And in the back of my mind, I'm thinking about isolating mom and trying to get in front of her and see what the story is. I know nothing further about this family. But I do know this. I do know the context that we live, and that's what I want to sensitize you today to. On pages 1 and 2 of the outline, I put out the statistics. Our population is aging. We have to be sensitive to that. That the people over age 65 in 2010, I think there's a statistic, constituted 13% of the population. In 2030, it's going to be 20% of the population. It's going to go up and up and up. I know this, that women are victimized twice as much as men, twice as much as men. I know that theft, you know, stealing, happens primarily by family members. I know that coercion or undue influence or trickery happens typically by third parties as well. So all of these factors come into play to be sensitive to the situation that this is not just someone coming in to do her will and power of attorney and healthcare document and perhaps a deed, but I, as the lawyer, really do need to know what is actually going on here. The information on page 2, the identifying the red flags of financial exploitation, let's just put these in our back pocket. I'm going to go through them, but as I say, I would intend that you're going to look at these from time to time. Theft, that's stealing, that's taking money from somebody. Somebody is looking the other way. It's like a pickpocket. It's like going to a grocery store and when somebody's not looking, stealing an apple. That's theft. And be on the lookout for different kinds of theft and how that happens. Fraud. A common story about fraud is this. And remember, fraud, as I said, is perpetuated typically by a third party. A person unrelated to the senior, I want to make that clear, unrelated to the senior, calls the senior. And it's kind of like the reverse perverted story of Red Riding Hood and the Big Bad Wolf, right? She went to grandma and said, you know, my gosh, you've got teeth and you got hair and all that stuff, right? Right? And so it's this. Somebody calls up and says, grandma? And then a male voice. And she says, Tommy, is that you? Ah, we set the bait. We've got the hook. We're reeling it in. Yeah, grandma, it's Tommy. Hey, grandma, don't tell my parents about this, but I went up to Canada, and I was on a fishing trip, and one of my friends had some marijuana in the car, and it's not legal in Canada, and we got pulled over, and now we're in this jail in Ontario, and it's really scary in here, and they tell me I need $5,000. And I don't want to call my parents. Can you wire me $5,000? And here's this foreign bank account, and on and on and on. And, of course, she's the victim of fraud. It happens time and time again, too many times, that one particular scheme, but other schemes about that. Identity appropriation. You know, as the lawyers, we can be nosy, right? So what the heck? Especially if it's the first meeting and I'm not charging, I can be as nosy as I want, right? Absolutely. And so one of the things I just want to check in on my seniors, whether or not they're my clients or not, is just to help them out. And I ask them, do you still keep your Social Security card in your wallet? Yeah. You want to see it? Do you still keep your old Medicare card in the wallet? Because, you know, that's so deceptive, right? That's, who would think that's anybody's Social Security number? Because there's an A after it, right? Right. Don't keep that in your cards. Don't do that. So I want to make sure that they have the ability that if their wallet or purse is stolen, that's all protected. Extorting people out of their money or using psychological extortion. I had a client once, and it kind of very similar to the story I'm telling about Mabel Nelson. And I asked her daughter to sit out in the conference room. This is not Mabel, this is somebody else. And her daughter willingly said so, but then she kind of snapped back at her mom and she said, "Well, of course, I just might leave you here, and I don't know how you're going to get home." And she was dead serious, right? And already the antenna like shoots up about that as well. And she cajoled her way to sit in with the meeting. Now, I resolved that situation the way I resolved Mabel's situation, which I'll get to later on in the program. But that, in my mind, is really subtle extortion. She comes downtown Minneapolis, and although we're in a more user-friendly neighborhood of Minneapolis with free parking and whatnot, it still is the big city. And for some people, it's still the big crime-ridden city as well. And so that's not funny to joke about, you know, how are you going to get home? I think that daughter well intended those comments. A misuse of the power of attorney document. And this is something that I think we really need to kind of think through. I was interested in, was Susan Gary, her comments today about the case, about the attorney liability. And that's actually another subject that I've been kind of thinking about. What is the liability for us as attorneys in terms of the power of attorney document? How much time do we really spend with our clients in counseling them about the appropriate representative? Because clients want to be fair to the kids, right? Because somehow the power of attorney, the fiduciary, equates in their mind to the inheritance, right? They mix it all up. It's like an ice cream swirl of chocolate and vanilla. And so they choose the oldest son, even though, you know, he's a serial bankruptcy filer. And he just, yeah, it's true. And he knows nothing about finances. But yeah, I don't want to hurt his feelings. And he's the oldest one, right? So we want to kind of explore that as well. Or the breach of fiduciary duty. That is, we chose the wrong person. And it starts out harmlessly, right? Use the power of attorney as the example. Harmless. Son, you know, he doesn't have much assets. He's between, I wouldn't say between paychecks, he's probably between jobs or careers, right? And he just needs a little help from get to here to there. So he loans himself money from mom. No paperwork, of course, just loans himself, helps himself with assets, with fully intending to repay those assets. But that doesn't happen, and he gets deeper and deeper and deeper and breaches that special fiduciary duty that is incumbent upon the fiduciary to act in the best interests, in this case, of the principal. And then denial of access to funds, walling a person off from funds, taking their mail, only handling transactions electronically. Newsflash, seniors don't do things electronically, at least not the seniors I know in Minnesota. Right? They like the bank statement that comes once a month. Heck, they even use a paper to pay checks and all that sort of thing. So when we start to see things on their statements where the bank statements are coming electronically, purchases are coming electronically, purchases on eBay or Amazon, gosh, I don't know. Maybe Portland is different, but the Twin Cities, my seniors don't quite shop in that particular way. So those are some of the red flags that sort of sensitize us to the areas of financial exploitation. I would summarize on the next page, on page 3, three categories. The categories in items 1 through 5 are inconsistencies, and I'll kind of delve into that a little bit. And the items 6 through 8 are living conditions, a person's welfare that doesn't seem to match. And then finally, the wall-off items I talked about, and that we can find in 9 through 15. So here's some telltale signs that I look for. Withdrawals of large sums of money from a bank account or extravagant expenditures. You know, mom was always the cloth coat kind of person, right? And she always drove a very modest older model car and lived a frugal lifestyle. So when we start to see her visa statement that there's large sums of money and they're to clothing stores and jewelry stores and furniture stores and other kinds of merchants, right? That's always a red flag. So in terms of that, I like to suggest to my clients if that they suspect any wrongdoing, they start to take a good look at what the withdrawals are happening in terms of the bank statements or the charge account statements. The next category, the welfare category, again, I think it belies one to be snoopy about those things. If somebody is suspecting that, let's paint a situation, let's say this. Let's say fire-to-launch son moves in with mom. Very common fact pattern, right? Especially right after the Great Recession, people were unemployed or underemployed, and so the family comes up with this great idea. Hey, let's have son John move in with mom. It will keep her out of the nursing home. He'll have a place to live. He'll take care of her, right? And then it's a win-win situation for everybody. Well, we suspect that maybe mom's welfare is not being taken care of. We saw her the other day, and her appearance looked to be disheveled, or she looked unusually skinny, right? That she's lost some weight. So maybe we want to be proactive and in her home, look around and look for a couple of telltale things. First of all, open the refrigerator, a very practical thing to do. See what's in there. Does she have nutritious food? Is the food outdated? Is it spoiled? Are the shelves well stocked, right? And then extend to the pantry and see what's there as well. And then as long as we're opening doors, let's go to the medicine cabinet and see what kinds of medications are there. See if there's any pills that are empty, pill boxes, if the prescriptions have been expired. Being sort of putting up our antenna and looking around in the household for those kinds of things is really, really important. And then I mentioned the walled-off sorts of things, the mail being redirected, prepaid services. And another element that I just want to say about mom's ability, and I'm just saying mom generically, but mom's ability to be accessed. Every time I call mom, she seems to be busy or preoccupied, or she can't come to the phone right now, right? You know, when is it that I can actually have a conversation, that I can be isolated with her, that I can find out what's going on? So those are some of the things that make us more sensitive to what the situation is. There are some legal remedies as well, and there's two main legal remedies. One is mental capacity, and the other is undue influence. So let's kind of explore that. We may remember from law school, and this is on page 3 of the outline, we may remember from law school the ability to determine mental capacity in terms of entering into a will. And that information is here, right? There's the four elements. And I love this. It sounds so English, common law. I feel like I should be riding my horse with saddlebags as we say this, right? Does the client know the natural objects of his or her bounty, the natural objects? I used to come home from work when the kids were younger and say, ah, the natural objects of my bounty, right? Who likely would receive my assets, right? Is it my spouse and then the two, in the words of Garrison Keillor, of course, two above-average Minnesota children, right? Would it be those, or would it be the pool girl, right? And by the way, newsflash, my wife Marsha and I have no pool. We have no pool, right? So who's the natural object of my bounty? If a person can kind of formulate, they kind of understand their family situation, that's it. Does the client understand the nature and extent of her bounty? Ah, or his or her bounty, the nature and extent, ah, all my stuff, right? Now, it's not stuff in the sense that I know it down to the penny, right? Except I do know the value of my Packer stock, that I know, and that is priceless, of course. But it's not that. I don't need to know the value in my 401k account. In fact, frankly, my friends, after today, I really don't want to know the value of my 401k account. But the fact that I have a 401k account, and if it's $100,000 or $2 million, that's material. I need to know kind of which direction that's heading, right? I have an IRA account. I have life insurance. Again, I don't need to know the exact dollar amounts of anything, cash value or death benefit. I need to know that. I need to know I have a house. If I start to say I have hunting land and I have a cabin and I have a farm interest and I don't, then maybe I don't know if I really know the natural objects of my bounty. So it's sort of a good enough kind of standard, but it's there. Now, the ability to hold that together at the time, you know, formulate that intention, understanding who is likely to receive my assets, what generally are my assets, hold that together at the time I'm doing the will with intention of understanding that this will is going to pass on the stuff I have to the important people in my life. That's the test. It's a low test. It's a low bar. In fact, to tip over mental capacity does usually require clear and convincing evidence, a much higher evidential standard than a mere preponderance of the evidence like in any other civil case. So that's the standard. So it typically is easily met, and at least in terms of a will. Remarkably, a bit higher standard is for things like a financial power of attorney or a healthcare directive document or even a deed, giving a deed, conveying property, that quick deed, right? So why do you think that is? Why is there a little higher standard than a will? Well, I don't know. I don't know the reason, but I have a suspicion. And my suspicion is that the higher standard, I guess if I was a judge writing an opinion, a higher standard affects the individual person at that time during their life, right? If I name somebody as my power of attorney, right, they have the ability, particularly with a durable power of attorney, to step in at any given time and handle my financial affairs. And if they dissipate those affairs and I'm living, right, then that affects my life. Healthcare directive document, my healthcare during my life as well. And a deed, I'm conveying property during my life. I'm divesting myself of property during my life. And then, of course, us lawyers like to confuse the situation entirely, right? Well, what about a transfer on death deed, a deed where it's a beneficiary deed in nature? Some states call it a ladybird deed, right? What about that? That might be a hybrid analysis of both the testamentary analysis under the will, but also the contractual analysis, which is higher. What about beneficiary designation forms? Think about it. Think about your clients. Think about yourselves. At least where I come from, most people, their financial assets, the largest concentration of their assets, and think about your own personal portfolios, are governed by beneficiary forms. They're not governed by a will or a trust. They're governed by beneficiary forms. I'm talking about the big three. Retirement account assets, IRAs, 401ks, those kinds of things. Annuities, some might have annuities. And life insurance, largest concentration of assets. How's that analyzed? Well, that's analyzed typically under a hybrid standard as well, the testamentary standard, but also the higher standard about contractual matters. And then finally, what about a revocable trust? Because, you know, it affects a person today in terms of handling their assets during their lifetime, but it's also testamentary in nature. So that's more of a hybrid type of a standard. This notion about capacity, having the mental capacity to enter into a will or the slightly higher standard affecting one's lifetime, I think a telling case is the case on page 5. It's the Groves case. L.N.P. Groves. And in this case, the court recognizes the following. The court recognizes that capacity is not an all or nothing proposition. It's not that a person has no capacity at one given point in time, but they have capacity at a later point in time. That's the recognition here, that can change, that can be transitory. Capacity is task-specific. Well, we all know that, right? Sometimes we're good at certain things, and sometimes we're not good at certain things. One of the things that Michael asked me to give something humorous about the introduction is I said that when I dictate, and yes, I'm that old school guy who still dictates with a tape recorder, and well, now it's electronic, and it gets shot where it goes. But to break up the monotony, because, you know, it is a state and disability planning documents that I'm dictating about, I do it in character voices, right? Jack Nicholson dictating a will, right? Sammy Davis Jr. dictating a trust, right? Got it? And so the thing about that, though, is that I'm tone deaf, and so it all sounds the same. In my mind, it sounds, you know, like it's different, but it sounds the same. So I'm really not good at that. That's not a good specific. But heck, I can balance my checkbook with the best of them, right? And that's the same thing with capacity. There are things that people are good at and things that people are not good at as well. Capacity can be situational, motivational, contextual. I think of this situation. So I told you I go into the office about 8 in the morning, and sometimes that's a little later for some of the lawyers in our office. But that's just the way I'm wired. I like to, you know, sleep into maybe 6 or 6:30 or so, okay? That's not the way my older clients operate. Oh, no. Oh, no. They're up at 4 in the morning. And that's true. And their sharp time of the day is 7 in the morning. I'm not so sharp. They're sharp at 7 in the morning, right? If I would see them right now as, say, 1:50 in the afternoon right now, well, I'm raring to go. I'm good. I'm good. They may not be so good. They may be sunsetting. They may be time for their long afternoon nap, right? So were they competent at 7 and maybe not so competent at 2? Yeah, that's what the law recognizes, that they can be competent at 7 a.m. and maybe not so competent at 2 in the afternoon. So it's transitory in that way. So for my clients, unfortunately, I do get up a little bit earlier when necessary and meet them at 7 a.m. because I want to catch them at their best. So we recognize that. Change in circumstances or surroundings. It's interesting that the Groves case mentioned that because I had a case a few years ago, maybe more than 5 years ago now, where it was one of those things that just remains with you. You know how you have those situations, whether you're a lawyer or other kind of advisor, and these clients, they just stay with you. Their situation is so remarkable. Well, this was unusual. They were brought to my attention by their niece. They had no children. It was a married couple. He was in one care facility on the western suburbs of Minneapolis, and you know the Twin Cities are side-by-side cities, and she was at a care facility on the eastern side of St. Paul, virtually opposite ends of the 10-county metro area, and probably for good reason, because they had an over 50-year marriage, but it recently came to light that he had physically and verbally abused her over virtually the entire term of the marriage, and it was awful. And so I met him, and I was to help with their estate plan. They wanted to still leave everything to each other, and then they had a common set of contingent beneficiaries. That they still wanted. I wanted to make sure that I could do that. And he was okay. He was kind of not one of my favorite characters. But when I met her in the nursing home, the only way I can think of it is she was like a wilted flower, that she was cowering, and she was quiet, and she kind of kept to herself, and I just didn't know if she even had any mental capacity to be able to really formulate intentions as to what she wanted to do. But we wanted to continue with this, and that's what we do. And so I visited with her a few months later, and I started to see a much different person. I started to see a person who was a little bit more upright and a little bit more with it. And she even cracked a joke. And that was great. And so we talked about putting together her estate plan and other documents that she would have. They didn't want each other. She did not especially want him to be her representative. And so ultimately, about a month later, I went out to visit her to review the documents and get them signed. And I saw a much different person as well. Well, now she's the darling of the staff because she was with it mentally, and the staff gravitates to those that they can interact with. And she was doing knitting, and she was knitting things for people in the care facility. And it was just a much different personality. Now, when I first met her 3 months earlier, I don't think she had mental capacity. But I think as things moved on and she improved, and I think that whole environment too, right, away from him, regular meals, hygiene, whatnot, right, I think it just made her feel like a much better person, and I think she had capacity. And so that's the elusive nature of capacity. At one time, it can be present. At another time, it can't. And so we want to search for that and see what we can do. What I do is if there's a question about capacity, I ask my clients this, and I know we've gone on to other ways as well, and I'll talk about that, but I ask my clients this. I say, would you submit to a psychological examination? Would you go to a doctor and submit to this? Just because I don't know who's going to challenge the will. I do believe in the adage, where there's a will, there's a relative. I do believe in that adage, right? And it just helps it, and it helps me be a better attorney with them. Some people have said this, have you ever filmed the signing of a will? And I never have, and that scares me, because the first time I do, that will be the suit, and I'll be called up on the stand and say, Mr. Barron, you're esteemed, I'll just throw that in, my mother would have said that, right? In your esteemed legal career, right, have you ever filmed a will signing, right? And I haven't. So why did you decide to do it this time? Now, I don't know, I'm going to stammer and stutter and say, I don't know. Somebody once said, well, you tell them, because this is the first time I knew that a jerk like you is going to try to fight this, and so I wanted to be prepared. Possibly that could be a way to handle it, but I don't know. I know from the horror stories I've heard that sometimes people don't appear well on camera, and now we're stuck with this as well. I've also done this too, though I've had a colleague sit in on the meeting and take notes and independently put together a memo as to what they've seen and observed. And I also did this too, and you can just do this the more you practice law, because you can always say no as well. You can say, I'm sorry, poor folks, but I can't help you with this. This person is not competent. This happened to me actually just last week in a hospital. I went out to sign the will, and husband was not doing too well. Mom was just fine and sharp. And even though it was a simple situation, everything to mom and dad, and then everything to the two kids, he was catatonic, and he couldn't communicate, and I couldn't get anything out of him. Even despite my good humor, I could get nothing out of this poor man. I'm still not going to give up hope. But on that particular day in that particular hospital, and even though I came out with myself as the notary, and I came out with the witnesses, and the documents had been signed, had been reviewed, a number of drafts, he just wasn't competent. Mom was not happy with me. I'm willing to try it again. But, you know, I don't know if I would sign the documents, and then there would be something unusual. Somebody wanted to challenge it. The son, who was not named the personal representative, feels some sense of entitlement, and he should be the personal representative, and he challenges it, then it's going to be a real problem. I don't think I've ever lost sleep, and I want to suggest this to you, ever lost sleep over a client that I chose not to represent. I've never lost sleep. It's the ones that I was too stupid to keep them around that I've lost too much sleep, right? So I commend that to you as well. I have some case studies in here on page 6, but let's just turn back to Mabel Nelson, right? So she's in the office, and she comes in the office, and I meet with her and her daughter, and I greet them in the conference room. Mabel's 86 years old. She's kind of bent over. I tell daughter, I said, well, I'm here to help Mabel. I want to identify Mabel as my client. And I want to get her sense of what's going on. In other words, I want to isolate her, and I want to really test her mental capacity. Now, here's something. Daughter says, well, no, I need to help her out. Mom gets a little confused once in a while. She's fine, but I need to help her out. Now, in fairness, I could use daughter Judy to be a big help, because Mabel could be a nice person. She could meet that lower standard to do a will. She knows of the natural objects of her bounty, and I don't know at this point who they are. Maybe it's just Judy, I don't know. And maybe she has an idea of her stuff, but it's just hard to put things together. It's hard to move the conversation along. So sometimes you can use the adult child to make the situation flow more smoothly. So I say, okay, well, let's just try it. But ultimately, I will want to talk to Mabel, okay? And so we go back to the conference room, and Judy is continuing to drive our conversation. Well, one of the things I like to ask about is, it's kind of that social work concept, where is the client, where do they stand? So one of the things, and you do this too, what existing legal documents do you have in place? And so I see in her legal documents that she has a will that was done 20 years ago, as I said, leaving everything to Dad. He's now deceased. And I see that there's 6 children, Judy being one of them. So already that flag goes up. And I'm trying to get a sense from Mom as to what she wants, if she really wants to leave everything to Judy. Is it a certain percentage that she wants to leave to Judy? Maybe she just wants Judy to be her representative. You know, it's that ice cream swirl of the representative and the fiduciary all rolled into one. So I don't know at this point. So I'm just going to leave it at this. I don't know if Mom has capacity or not. I need to get in front of her and really isolate and get a better understanding of the situation. I'm going to suggest that on page 6 and going into page 7, the Alzheimer's Association and even our friends at the Security and Exchange Commission have weighed in about competency matters and diminished capacity. I won't go through all of these things, but there's a number of factors to help us weigh and evaluate what's going on. There's another thing, though, I want to focus on here in this situation. I said I represent Mom, and this is the material on page 8. I need to do that time and time again and remind Mom and Judy, for that matter, that Mom is my client if I choose to represent Mom. Now, under our rules of ethics, I have options. I could represent just Judy. I really could. That I could do that under our rules as long as I disclose that. I could represent Mom and solely Mom, right? Or I could represent purportedly the family and try to bring things in for the family. This particular situation, I would choose to represent Mom. I would choose to represent the family more if it was medical assistance planning, asset protection planning, and I discerned that it was really fulfilling the wishes under the will in treating the beneficiaries as they were. In other words, advancing gifts now during one's lifetime, but they're consistent with how they were to be advanced under the will. So in my engagement letter, I may want to say a couple of things. I may want to say time and time again that I represent Mom. I may also want to suggest that the engagement letter allows me to step outside of any restrictions under the rules of ethics in communicating with a third party on Mom's behalf. That is, if I start to see that Mom truly is slipping, that if she is victimized by financial exploitation, I don't need to keep those matters in confidence. And when we talk about the rules of ethics as we wrap it up today, there are some restrictions of me normally disclosing that information. And so I want to identify the third party that I can disclose information to and under what circumstances when I can disclose information. And basically those circumstances are when I, as the lawyer, deem it appropriate to disclose. It's my judgment that I want in my engagement letter. So think about that as you're crafting your engagement letters, and we'll study the rules in a minute. And I'm going to suggest this to accountants and financial advisors and even bank personnel, trust officers, that you consider thinking through who you can disclose when you notice these things, okay? All right, so let's talk about the other aspect to a legal challenge, undue influence, making a person do something that they normally wouldn't do. The first thing that I want to look for with undue influence is, am I analyzing a situation that might be ripe for the seeds of undue influence to take place? You know, like a plant has to be planted in a garden? Well, you have to have the special kind of soil and fertilizer and rain and sunshine and all that. That makes it ripe to grow things. Not that things are going to grow, that the weed of undue influence is going to grow from that situation, but you have to look for the potentially that kind of situation in order to see if undue influence could in fact happen. The biopsychosocial approach is an approach that looks at biological aspects, diseases, injuries, drugs, psychological aspects, character traits, relationships, social issues, cultural, religion, finances, support networks. It reminds me of this situation. So my wife and I are not from the Twin Cities. We are both from the great state of Wisconsin. And if you must know, our first date was we got a couple of sandwiches. We piled into my 1970s Chevy Nova, and we drove the back roads of Wisconsin listening to our Packer game on AM radio. Now, is that true love, right? Hello? That's right. Didn't have a six-pack, allegedly, right? Got it. And so, being in the Twin Cities and having our parents over in Wisconsin, there was a couple that we met through some friends of a friend's, and they adopted us, and it was so nice. They really adopted us and took a personal interest in us. They became like another set of grandparents for the kids, and I would rely on them both for professional advice and guidance as my career was developing. And I really owe a debt, Marcia and I owe a debt of gratitude to them. I want to say it's been about 3 years now, but this couple was shopping at their favorite place, Sam's Club, right? And they were in Sam's Club, and they picked up some groceries, and they were walking in the parking lot to their car, and apparently they were talking to each other, their heads were turned to each other, and a car backed up and hit the woman and knocked her down so much that her head hit the pavement, and she suffered a significant concussion. And she's never been quite the same since. And she acknowledges that she's forgetful and her executive skills are diminished and whatnot. About 10 months after that, and this is a traditional couple, right? He was the man, all 5'4" of him, he was the man, right? And he handled all the finances and kind of conducted the world for them. And they all socialized with other couples, men and women. He suddenly passed away, and it was very tragic, and she relied on him so much. And I see her now, and I see no indication that she's going to be victimized in any way, but she, in my mind's eye, reminds me of that biopsychosocial approach. Biologically, things have changed. She's had this head injury. Psychologically, things have changed as well. Her husband is not there. He was the driver, right? So she's not getting out as much. And she relied on him for finances, right? He was the guy back primarily back in the 80s who would sniff out the highest CD return at a CD in a bank. That's why they have 12 different accounts now, and it drives me crazy, right? And they have, you know, all the loot and spoils to show for that, the toaster and the blender and the dishes and all that stuff, right? So they got all that. So he's gone, right? And she's always in a quandary about, I've got this CD due, and what should I do, and what should I do? And then finally, social. They're, unfortunately, I hate to say this, but they're not a couple anymore. And if you're not a couple, you don't get invited out to play bridge, and you don't go out with the other couples. And, you know, God forbid, if there's a, well, it shouldn't, I mean, it's a happy thing, but if there's a wedding or something, God forbid, in the sense that your place is the widow's table, right? We all know the widow's table, where the women who are not married sit, which is horrible, which is just absolutely horrible, in my opinion. But because of that, she could be that kind of person who could be ripe for the handyman to come by, right? Or somebody who's just going to take her out, maybe the neighbor next door who's maybe a little bit down on her luck, and she's going to take her shopping. And sure enough, you know that there's going to be an appreciation there. So we think about that. So what to look for? We have anything that reduces or impairs cognition and all of those things right there. What to look at, this undue influence assessment, this idea. Well, if I'm the lawyer and putting on my lawyer hat, I want to look at medical records, I want to look at what's all taking place here and get an understanding. And then finally, maybe I want to do an examination and testing. I referred back to that. If I'm the lawyer and I'm going to be writing up some legal documents, I want to make sure that the person has their own free will. They're thinking things in their own free will. Which leads us back to Mabel Nelson, if I can tell some more things about Mabel here. When the daughter wouldn't leave the meeting, I felt that I was sort of at the end of what I could possibly do. And so, like any good lawyer, I asked for time, right? In fact, I think one of the best advice I've ever had was from an older lawyer who said, when you're faced with a tough situation, say, you know, I need to think about this and buy yourself some time. And I think that was a good thing. So in this situation, said, okay, well, let me think about what this will is going to look like, what this power of attorney is going to look like, what the healthcare directive is going to look like, what this quick deed is going to look like, and let me quote you a fee for my services. Ah, because that's it, right? The fee, how much does it cost, right? Maybe if it was too exorbitant, maybe daughter would go shop mom to somebody else. So I said, so just give me a chance, and I'll get back, and we'll figure this out. So what I did then is the next day, I did call mom, and I called her unbeknownst to daughter, just called her on the phone. And I said, so what's going on here, Mabel? I want to help you. It is unusual to leave everything to Judy. Judy possibly feels that she's your mom's primary caregiver, and she's the one really taking care of you. But what gives? And mom said, you know, I'm so glad you called, because I really don't want to leave everything to Judy. I really do love my children equally. It's true that Judy has played a more active role in my life over the past few months, and I'm really indebted to her because she gets me out more, and I appreciate that. She said that something came into Judy, that Judy recently had a divorce. That's why she has a bit more time on her hands as well, and Judy's been feeling very low about it. But she really would like to treat her children equally. Then she said, I don't mind if Judy is the fiduciary, that my words, not hers. I don't mind if she handles affairs. I'm thinking that may not be the best idea. I said, how about this? I said, what if we look at a third party? There are companies, you know, who can do this services. They're called trust companies, hello, right? Or other fiduciaries who can serve in this role. Maybe we can see what we can find. And so she said that she would be interested in doing that. And I said, here's what I'd like to do. I don't need to have you schlep downtown anymore. Why don't I just stop by your house and we'll have a visit about this, okay? So let's just hold it over for that. We'll talk more about that story. So we left it as I'm going to visit with her at her home. One of the things I do want to talk to her when I do visit at her home is this notion about the power of attorney document, two important disability documents, actually, the power of attorney and the healthcare directive document in particular. And that's found on page 10. And a couple of things I want to talk to her about the financial power of attorney document. I want to talk to her about the difference between the statutory short form power of attorney and a general power of attorney document. The statutory short form power of attorney, which Oregon has and other states have, is the product of the uniform law movement of the 60s. And the story usually goes like this. It was the banking lobby that came to the state legislatures and said, hey, can you adopt this nice uniform form? And I can tell you in Minnesota, I don't know the story in Oregon, but the banking lobby, they weren't so concerned about the larger banks in Minneapolis and St. Paul. They were concerned about the banks in all the small towns areas, with things we call outstate Minnesota. Because when a bank was presented with a financial power of attorney document, well, the bank didn't really want their officers making legal decisions. They would hire the local lawyer, Joe, who was also the criminal defense lawyer and likely the prosecutor and likely the personal injury lawyer and on and on and on, to review the document for the bank. And Joe would get to it in his sweet time and would charge a fee, naturally. And the bank was in a quandary. Do they pass this fee on to their customer, or how do they do this? So if they could put together a uniform document, you know, then it could be widely disseminated, and maybe we wouldn't need old Joe so much to review the documents. So the legislature obliged in Minnesota and also in other states, hence the statutory short form power of attorney. Remember, the genesis of the power of attorney then is on consumer access. The flip side of consumer access is consumer protection. The power of attorney document typically has a gifting limitation. And that gifting limitation is often tied to the federal exclusion amount, the annual exclusion amount, presently $15,000, right? Well, for the clients we're seeing, particularly with elder law and asset protection planning, we're advising naturally to transfer more than $15,000 per person per year. Yes, I know it comes off of, if you're married, your nearly $22.4 million federal exclusion. I know that. If I have a client who comes in with even $20 million, I'm going to talk to him about buying a nursing home. Yeah, just buy the darn place, right? Don't do asset protection planning. So we want to be careful about that. So when I'm dealing with a more senior population, I typically like to represent the general power of attorney document. I also want to talk to them in particular about the representatives. Now, in Mabel's case, perhaps an independent representative would be the way to go. But we're looking for somebody, not the oldest son, not daughter because she's married to son-in-law who knows something about the stock market, right? No, we want a couple of things. We want somebody who gets things done. You know, the person who can get from point A to point B, right? We don't necessarily want the engineering gene who wants to analyze, now what exactly is point A on the spectrum of points in the universe, right? We don't want that. We want to get things done, right? We want somebody who is smart enough to know what they don't know, and so they're going to reach out for help. Ah, there's an accounting issue. Ah, there's a financial planning issue here, right? That's the kind of representative we want. And I would also add to that, too, which is something often overlooked, somebody who has good communication skills, who can allow, who has the sense, who has the smarts to understand that if I'm running the show and my brother doesn't quite know what's going on, he might be healthily suspicious, right? Even though we all get along, we all sing from the same hymnal, everything is fine. So you know what? Even when he doesn't want information, I'm going to report information to him. I'm paying mom's bills. These are the bills that are paid. You know, these are where her accounts are at. A little psychology in order to keep him along in the process as well. That's good qualities of a representative. That's what we want. Finally, one last point about the power of attorney document that I want to make. I like my clients to execute multiple duplicate originals, multiple duplicates. Sometimes an institution or the county recorder's office wants an original, right? They may give it back, but they want it. And if we have originals, and I number them, that we can use simultaneously, it speeds up the process. So if we need to record a deed about something, you know, mom has a disability, we're selling the house, we have to give the original to the county recorder, we may well get it back. But meanwhile, the bank wants to see an original, and we can't approach the bank till we get the original back from the county recorder. Just speeds up the process for us, okay? Got it. Healthcare directive document, and I think this is over on page 16. It does a number of things. It does three main things for us, and it does two others that I'm going to commend makes for a happy family. The three things are it appoints the representatives. And again, a similar analysis takes place. Who best thinks like the person? Who best can make medical decisions? Whenever I've used, and I've always used, for the past 25 years, doctors, nurses, social workers, whenever I've used them to help with the language in my healthcare document, invariably they get back to me and they say two things. One, don't get terribly specific because medicine changes, so don't say I want this kind of therapy or this kind of medication. Talk in terms of a philosophy. And number two, impress upon your clients to choose the right representative who thinks like them, who can discern information, who can make calm, cool, collected judgments, right, on their behalf, and who they would ultimately trust as the representatives. That is critical. And make sure your clients, and this is so Minnesota, non-Minnesota, passive-aggressive, actually encourage your clients to have a conversation with the representatives. I know, unheard of. Really? We're going to have a conversation? No, it's important, right? And just take them out for coffee and talk about when is it that life would no longer be worth living? When is it do you think that some radical procedure should be tried? Just having that conversation just to kind of pick that up. The document also typically has a HIPAA release. I like to have that in the document as well. And it also expresses one's wishes. The two things that I would like my clients to add to the document is, one, what are their thoughts about organ and tissue donation? A person of any age can be an organ and tissue donor. Okay, maybe not hearts and lungs, traditional organs, but skin is considered an organ. Your cornea is considered an organ. And it's just really great to say in the document whether or not a person wanted to be an organ and tissue donor. Absent that, it becomes a flashpoint, particularly among the kids, which delves into, oh, mom wanted to be an organ and tissue donor. Really, are you sure? Mom was afraid of that sort of thing, and it's so invasive. Really? You think you know what mom wants? What the heck did you know about mom? Did you ever raise a finger to help her? On and on and on. You know how that kind of spreads, right? Got it. The second thing is burial and or cremation. Does mom want burial or cremation? And if she wants burial, where, right? If she wants cremation, and this is important, what's to happen with her ashes? What's to happen with her ashes? In Minnesota, we have a law pending in our legislature for funeral homes to dispose of assets after ashes after 7 years. Why? It's amazing, but funeral homes are inundated with unclaimed ashes, despite the fact that they've contacted the family for a variety of reasons. Emotionally, it's hard to pick it up. Dysfunctional families, right? They have to make that decision, right? And so it's an important thing to cover. I like to do 4 or 5 duplicate originals of the healthcare directive document. I like to make sure they're accessible. I want the agent to have one. And particularly, I want the agent to have it via email as well. Nobody leaves home without their smartphone anymore, right? And the agent then, this is the representative, the proxy, they're the ones that will have that information. I also want the doctor to have it. I want copies in their motor vehicle, in the glove box. I know that sounds hokey, but I want it there. I want it in their suitcase. And finally, I, as the lawyer, want it. Even though I may not have drafted the document, I may, but I may have not. They have it from some other source. At least I can be a resource. I can be helpful. If they're checking into the hospital and they don't happen to have their document, as a courtesy, I can email it or fax it wherever it needs to go. And that's a helpful thing to do. So in the last case here, I just want to just touch on the ethics. And I commend you to read through the ethics. You'll know as a lawyer, Rule 1.14 says we have to try to maintain a normal a relationship with the clients as possible. Disclosing confidential information is the subject of Rule 1.6. Now, disclosure of confidential information, our laws need to step it up a bit, our rules of ethics. It's usually predicated, as you'll see, on the disclosure of imminent physical harm. But we're talking about financial or emotional harm here. Now, there's badges and incidences of harm in terms of financial that would allow disclosure, but it's not entirely clear. That's why I get back to my letter about allowing for disclosure. On page 21, taking protective action, item 5, and notice substantial physical, financial, or other harm, a lawyer can take protective action. And then again, I would just suggest another badge and incident of being able to disclose is on page 24, comment 6 to rule 1.6, again, being able to take information. Perhaps we can learn from financial advisors, though, and I want to just recommend, and this happened after the materials were submitted, there's 2 FINRA rules I want you to keep in mind, 2 FINRA rules. One is rule 4512, and it was adopted February 5th, and it says that the financial advisor can request, in fact, is encouraged to request, a third party to report incidences to when they see, in their view, evidence of financial exploitation. And then there's Rule 2165, FINRA rule. And it says that in the discretion of the advisor, if it's written into their fee agreement, that they can place a hold of up to 15 days by freezing an account. That's great. If you can, you know, report, right, tell the world what you believe is going on, or at least this designated third party, and you can freeze the assets, you've got a leg up in terms of providing ultimately for protection for the senior. And speaking of protection, let's wrap it up by let's addressing Mabel's situation here. So we left off, I went to her home, and I admired all the Hubble figurines that were staring back at me. It was lovely, right? And the beautiful, might I say, lime green shag carpeting. It was gorgeous, right? And the avocado side-by-side refrigerator freezer. Remember that, right? And I said, you know, maybe what you should do is you should do an assessment. And she agreed to that. And the test came back. She does have mild dementia, but the doctor said that under the right circumstances, she could be competent. And the doctor also added that she thought she was being undue influenced by her daughter, which I thought so as well. So thank you very much, Doc. And so we all agreed to all this. So here's what we did. We set up a revocable trust. Mom wanted to set things up, and she had most things going with beneficiary designation forms anyway to the kids. I like the concept of the trust, though, because if it goes to the six kids, it goes outright to the six kids. And in this potentially dysfunctional family, right, then how are they going to pay any final expenses? Everybody's got to chip back a 1/6 interest. So at least you've got the trustee in control of the funds. She did agree to an independent trustee. Her daughter found out. She was not happy. She said horrible, awful things to her mother. She said horrible, awful things to me, but I'm an attorney, and I'm used to that sort of thing. And she cut herself out of Mom's life. So in our back pocket was another thing. It's Plan B, and that's turning to social services for transportation and companionship and Meals on Wheels and lining all of those sorts of things up as well, because that's really a major part of what's going on. And so in the final analysis, I sent off my bill for services, and I a few days later, I got this lovely card tucked in to the bill. And this is what we do. It says Stuart here. And then this is like Hallmark at its best. It says, thanks a ton for all you've done. All right? And then this is here, and I just need the bigger print. Dear Stuart, you know you knew that I was not the wrinkled, bent-over person you had met. As you said, I deserve dignity and respect. Thank you for finding me in me. I like that line. Thank you for finding me in me and making sure I got to do what I wanted to do. With appreciation, Mabel V. Nelson. That's why we do what we do. Thank you very much.